Fatihul Janan is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرونترخکاری اینجا کم ثواب داره دعا هم داره ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که این رو گفته بارم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, listeners. You are listening to the program Keys of Life, Mafatihul Hayat, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he talks about the key of life of being clean and he gives us 10 instructions. He says, خَمْسٌ مِنَ السُّنَنِ فِي الرَّأْسِ. There are 5 traditions in the head. وَخَمْسٌ فِي الْجَسَدِ. And there are 5 traditions in the body. So we have 10 traditions altogether. فَأَمَّا الَّتِي فِي الرَّأْسِ. As that which is in the head. What must we do with the head? First, he says, فَالسُّوَاك. Brushing your teeth. That's a tradition, a sunnah of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. 1. وَأَخْذُ الشَّارِبُ. For the men to trim their mustaches. وَفَرْقُ الشَّعْرِ. To comb your hair, to fix it. And that's just very straightforward. وَالْمَضْمَضَةُ. And to gargle water in your mouth. وَالْإِسْتِنْشَاقُ. To inhale water with your nose. So these are 5 things we need to do with our body. And you can see mainly they rotate around the mouth area. Because we have to, you know, during our day, we face one another. So I have to make sure that my breath is not smelly, that it smells nice, it smells fresh. So I don't harm those whom I come in contact with. وَأَمَّا الَّتِي فِي الْجَسَدِ. As for that which is in the body, he says, فَالْخِتَان. A person needs to be circumcised, and that is a compulsory in jurisprudence in fiqh. وَحَلْقُ الْعَانَ. And for a person to shave his pubic area. وَنَسْفِ الْإِبْطِ. And to shave the armpit. وَتَقْلِيمُ الْأَظَافِرِ. And to cut one's nails. وَالْإِسْتِنْجَاءُ. And for a person that when he goes to the bathroom, he washes his areas, private parts, cleanly, which is also a wajib. Now you can see these 5 things when it comes to the body. They are also the Imam concentrates on areas that sometimes are neglected. When it comes to pubic area, for example, when it comes to the armpits, when it comes to the nails, people forget to do them. Or at least they get lazy to do them. The Ahl Bayt, they say no, it needs to be constantly cleaned, be it when it comes to the private parts or the armpits, because you live with a spouse, be it male or female. You need to look nice and clean for your spouse. When it comes to people, for example, you need to make sure that you smell nice. And when it comes to nails, we said, because nails accumulate a lot of dirt, a lot of bacteria. And when it comes to making sure that your private parts are cleaned and, you know, the purification done correctly, because tahara is a compulsory act before any act of worship like salah, for example. So we have to constantly maintain the cleanness of our body and the cleanness of our head. So the Ahl Bayt alayhim as-salam, they did not leave anything unturned or anything unspoken of, especially when it comes to the cleanness of the human body. The hadith says, Allah is clean and He loves cleanness. And the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says, cleanness is part of iman, an-nadafatu min al-iman. If a person is dirty, then surely his iman is short. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There Was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, says more than 11,000 Yemeni children have been killed or maimed since the Saudi-led aggression against the impoverished country began in 2015. The agency says hundreds of thousands of children also remain at risk of death from starvation or preventable diseases. That's while the true toll of the conflict is likely to be far higher. According to the agency, about 2.2 million Yemeni children are acutely malnourished. One quarter of them aged under five. Most of them are at extreme risk from cholera and other vaccine-preventable diseases. Described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis by the UN, nearly three-quarters of Yemen's population is said to be in need of humanitarian aid and protection. UNICEF is seeking over $480 million to respond to the crisis in Yemen over the next year and has warned that lack of predictable funding puts children's lives and well-being further at risk. The agency has also called on the warring sides to renew a UN-brokered truce, which was announced in April and expired in October without an agreement to extend it. At least 62 children have been killed or wounded since then. The collapse of Yemen's ceasefire risks rolling back some of the progress that has been made after the lifting of a Saudi blockade on Yemen that has prevented airplanes and ships from entering and leaving the country. While both sides have blamed the other for failure of a lasting ceasefire, Yemen's Ansarullah movement has stated that restoring peace in Yemen is not possible unless the invading countries abandon their arrogant mentality. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 with arms and logistics support from the US and other Western states. The objective was to reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi and crush the popular Ansarullah movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have died ever since, either as a result of war or indirectly through unsafe drinking water, disease outbreaks, hunger, and other impacts. In In Yemen, thousands of civilian and child deaths have been blamed on Saudi-led airstrikes, which have hit markets, weddings, funerals, residential homes, and hospitals. In addition, Yemen's health ministry said last month that 80 newborn babies lose their lives on a daily basis because the war-torn country does not have the required medical equipment due to the Saudi-led war and blockade. Yemeni officials say the use of prohibited weapons is one of the reasons behind a growing trend of children's death. Several human rights organizations have already acknowledged and condemned Saudis for using such arms. Since launching the war, with the support of Washington, the Saudi-led coalition has used internationally banned weapons, including U.S.-made cluster bombs, to target residential areas. Apart from the war, Riyadh has imposed a blockade on Yemen, which combined have claimed lives of hundreds of thousands of people. The military aggression has destroyed much of the country's infrastructure, including health sector. Meanwhile, Sana'a has warned foreign companies against plundering energy resources of the country, stressing that it will spare no effort to defend national sovereignty and safeguard public interests and health. The Saudi-led coalition and their proxies have looted more than $13 billion in Yemeni oil revenues between 2016 and 2021. The large amount could have been used to pay the salaries of employees in the National Salvation Government, reduce the exchange rate, and help improve the living standards for Yemenis and alleviate their suffering. The States has revealed it was pressing the United Nations not to update a blacklist of companies doing business in illegal Israeli settlements within the occupied West Bank. That's despite Washington's calls on its ally to stop expansion in occupied Palestinian territory. State Department spokesperson Vedant Patel stated that the United States will oppose any work to update the UN blacklist and has conveyed its concern directly with the Office of the High Commissioner. In February 2020, the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights published a list of companies operating in Israeli settlements. The list comprises 112 companies, including Israeli and American ones. The initial publication, which listed U.S. companies including Airbnb, Expedia, and TripAdvisor, was denounced by then-administration of Donald Trump, which had reversed long-standing U.S. opposition to settlements in the West Bank. The statement comes just days after the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken claimed that the Biden administration would oppose the Israeli settlement expansion and any bid to annex the West Bank. Since 1967, the Israeli occupation has established more than 230 settlements in the West Bank and Al-Quds, with over 500,000 settlers living in them to date. Despite the UN Security Council condemning the building of settlements, which under international law are all illegal, the Israelis continue expanding the annexation of more Palestinian land until today, with no prospect of stopping in the future. Palestine has slammed the U.S. move to pressure the United Nations not to update its list of companies operating in Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki told Voice of Palestine that the Palestinian leadership rejects any U.S. pressure on the UN and its operating institutions. He added that his ministry is working to arrange a meeting with the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk. His remark came after U.S. State Department announced that Washington continues to oppose any action to update the list and has raised concerns directly with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Emboldened by Washington's all-out support, Israel's illegal settlement activities surged under former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu during Trump's administration. The construction activities are in defiance of United Nations Security Council Resolution 2334, which pronounced settlements in the West Bank and East Al-Quds a flagrant violation under international law. In a speech on Sunday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that Washington would judge Benjamin Netanyahu's incoming regime by actions and not personalities. Controversial Israeli politician Netanyahu is likely to return to power after striking a coalition deal with the extreme right outfits, including religious Zionism, which could be put in charge of constructing illegal settlements and the Tel Aviv regime's land grab policies in the occupied Palestinian territories. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called on the international community to criminalize Israeli violations against Palestinians and to hold the occupying regime accountable for its crimes. The movement has stressed that Israeli crimes constitute a flagrant violation of the principles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the international law, reaffirming its commitment to the legitimate Palestinian rights.
The United States is pressing the UN not to update a blacklist of companies doing business in illegal Israeli settlements. The US has said things like it opposes any work to update it, or our view is that this database only serves to reinforce an anti-Israel bias that too often finds traction in UN venues. It also said that this database poses a genuine threat to companies doing business or considering business operations in the region. Yet the U.S. statements lack any concern about how these settlements are illegal in the first place. The U.N. Human Rights Office published a list back in the year 2020. It was a database of more than 100 companies that it said are doing business in Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. The database took more than 3 years to complete. It was hailed by campaign groups as a significant step forward in making sure that big business respected international law. The overwhelming majority of the 112 firms named on the database were Israeli, including many of the country's main banks. But the list also included a number of well-known international companies, including, among others, Motorola Solutions, General Mills, TripAdvisor, and Airbnb of the U.S., Apodo, and J.C. Bamford of the United Kingdom, and Alstom of France. Israel's largest banks provide services that help support, maintain, and expand unlawful settlements by financing their construction in the occupied West Bank, including partnering with developers to build structures on land unlawfully seized from Palestinians. A 41-page report called Bankrolling Abuse, Israeli Banks in West Bank Settlements, detailed the scope of banking activities in settlements and the violations to which these activities contributed. Israel's seven largest banks provided services to the settlements. But funding for illegal settlements took the form of donations, like from the U.S. In the year 2015, an investigation into private U.S. funding of settlements revealed a network of tax-exempt charities that funneled hundreds of millions of dollars to Jewish communities in the West Bank. The money was transferred from New York, Miami, Texas, ending up in Hebron or the Old City of Jerusalem, and all came from organizations for which donations were tax-deductible in the U.S. Israel is already suffering from the BDS movements, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and to pressure Israel to comply with international law. One of the issues that BDS exposes are products that are made in settlements and sold outside of Israel. BDS says the purchase of these products contributes to the Israeli regime and companies operating in occupied Palestinian lands. Israel has built more than 100 settlements in territories it captured from Jordan during a war in 1967. Under international law, the settlements in both the West Bank and Al-Quds, which are home to more than 600,000 people, are considered illegal, although Israel and the U.S. dispute such a characterization. They contribute to a discriminatory regime in which Israeli authorities restrict and stunt Palestinian economic development while subsidizing and supporting Israeli settlements built on land unlawfully seized from Palestinians. International humanitarian law forbids an occupying power from using land except for military purposes for the benefit of the local population living under occupation. Even though the U.S. opposes illegal settlements, its actions by all means support Israel and falls way short of taking any action to stop it. and now with an extreme far-right administration that the incoming Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is forming, settlement building may move at an accelerated pace.
For me, the results of the last elections from last week is no less than a revolution in the national sense and in my personal life, because I've been yearning for a moment when the powers that are for the great Israel and for Jewish values, that these political powers will be in government.
The new Israeli administration, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu and National Security Minister Ben-Gvir, have agreed to legalize settlements. They announced that they will move ahead and amend what's called a disengagement law in order to enable settlers to settle in the northern occupied West Bank. It would legalize dozens of illegal West Bank outposts, something known as Young Settlements. All of this spells bad news for Palestinians who are fighting for their land.
President Xi hails a new era of relationships with the Persian Gulf state during his meeting with King Salman and his three-day stay at Yamama Palace in Saudi Arabia. The world's largest exporter of crude oil, joined by the world's largest importer of it, signed a comprehensive strategic partnership agreement that involved the Chinese tech giant Huawei. Huawei is one of the companies that just recently was barred from exporting its equipment to the U.S. because of a recent imports ban in the U.S. on certain high-profile Chinese tech firms, including the likes of ZTE and Hikvision. While this was the most restrictive ban, it is not an isolated ruling. Anti-Chinese rhetoric became mainstream during Donald Trump's presidency when he banned all of Huawei's 5G equipment from the U.S. and even by extension in some EU countries. He also banned U.S. citizens from owning Xiaomi stocks, labeling the company as a communist Chinese military company. Despite the U.S. security officials warning that equipment from Chinese brands such as Huawei in the field of telecommunications can be used to collect sensitive information, most of the 5G infrastructure in the Persian Gulf states is built, at least with the partial assistance from Huawei. With all the hassle that the U.S. has been causing these Chinese businesses, it was only a matter of time before they looked elsewhere to grow their business, as relationships between the U.S. and China are shaky at best. Now Saudi Arabia has become an important destination to grow these brands, but on the other side, Saudi Arabia's relationships with the U.S. is also at a low point, and King Salman's meeting with Xi Jinping solidifies the signal that was already being sent that Saudi Arabia is inching away from the U.S. This is becoming more and more apparent over the disagreements between the two countries over energy policies, security guarantees, and human rights issues. The U.S. isn't making inflammatory comments about the visit, but the coordinator for strategic communications of U.S. National Security Council, John Kirby, did say that, quote, "we're mindful of the influence that China is trying to grow around the world." Saudi Arabia's energy minister said that the relationship between the two countries is witnessing an epoch-making milestone as he vowed that the kingdom will remain China's credible and reliable partner when it comes to oil production. Saudi Arabia isn't the only country warming up to China and even Russia, as the OPEC Plus decision to cut down on oil production amid rising demands from the West and especially the U.S. was a joint decision between the kingdom and Russia as the leaders of the major oil exporting organization. While Saudi Arabia sees the U.S. as its top security partner, the recent shakeup in their relationships, especially as a result of that very same OPEC Plus decision, has prompted the oil-rich kingdom to diversify on its partners list. It has shown that it does not want to hurt its relationship with Russia, as they have significant shared interests as leaders of the most influential crude oil exporting organization, and now it is showing that it is not shying away from cozying up to the US's trade war rival, China. As the use of Chinese yuan in the China-Saudi oil settlements is becoming increasingly more likely, especially during President Xi's visit to the kingdom, There is also the possibility of Saudi Arabia joining BRICS, as interest has been shown by the kingdom to join the trade-centered organization that also includes Russia as a member state. If, in fact, Saudi Arabia agrees to receive the Chinese yuan in exchange for its oil, that will be considered a massive blow to the falling hegemony of the US dollar in world trade, and especially in oil. This de-dollarization effort has been accelerating, and the first major instance of it happened as Western sanctions first started pouring in on Russia to limit its trade potential. What ended up happening was that as China's oil imports from Russia went up, state-owned oil enterprises increasingly used the Chinese yuan as payments. While all European Union member states are one way or another forced to cooperate with the US in sanctioning Russia, even if at an extremely high cost, the rest of the world is seeing less and less of an obligation to bend down to the will of the once hegemonic superpower as they see the prospect of a multipolar world more and more plausible and desirable.
In the limelight.
Following the energy crisis and unprecedented inflation in England, the supporting institutions of the UK's National Health Service, NHS, are looking to create warm banks in order to protect the vulnerable individuals of the society against the risk of death due to frostbite or starvation. This is while the head of the British National Health Service had previously warned about the danger to life that the lack of heating systems threatens people in winter. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Please stay tuned. The nationalnews.com reports the United Kingdom has set up more than 3,200 warm banks across the country for people who cannot afford to heat up their homes amid cost of living and energy crisis. Operated by local authorities and charities, the areas provide a safe and warm environment for people who are trying to make ends meet. As the bone shivering cold sees temperatures dropping to as low as 10 degrees Celsius. Nora, a jobless woman in her 50s who regularly visits a warming center, said, "We are all struggling with everything, gas, electricity and food. Until a year ago, I could get by on benefits." Retired Brian, 65, said his energy bill has tripled from £80 a month. At home, he wears a dressing gown over his clothes and a sleeping bag. The public warming spaces also set up in churches and libraries come in different shapes and sizes. And some of them also provide food, hot drinks, and internet access. Daniel Andrews, partnership manager at Wandsworth Library, said that since becoming a warm bank, the site had recorded an increase in visitors. A parent at Wandsworth Library told The National they were visiting with their child to keep warm. She said, "We are here because outside is very cold and there is no space where you can stay with a little child." Warm Welcome, a campaign group offering people warm spaces in their local areas, says that they are determined to equip and support thousands of free, warm and welcoming spaces in communities across the UK. Warm Welcome's website says, "We believe everyone should have a warm and welcoming space to go to this winter, which is why our network of community organisations, churches, libraries, businesses and other faith groups across the UK
have opened their doors to provide exactly that. David Barkley, manager of the Warm Welcome campaign, called it unacceptable that people are being forced to decide whether to heat their homes or eat. Many UK organizations have cautioned that thousands of people with low incomes are at risk during the extreme low temperatures hitting the UK, as average energy bills are twice as higher than they were this time last year. According to YouGov's newly released data, only one in six Britons, about 18%, said that they had the heating on and that it was both as hot as they like and on for as long as they like. The think tank Institute for Government defines the UK's cost of living crisis as the fall in real disposable incomes that is adjusted for inflation and after taxes and benefits that the UK has experienced since late 2021. The UK's and Europe's energy crisis has been building up over the past year as increased demand during the post-COVID reopening of economies coincided with Russia's special operation in Ukraine and a subsequent squeeze on gas supplies into Europe. The WeForum.org writes, warm banks are spaces where people can go to heat up for free if they can't afford to turn on the heating in their home this winter. They have been organized by charities, councils, and community groups across the UK to help people struggling with the surging cost of energy. Over 50% of councils in England and Wales are involved in setting up warm banks or supporting groups who are doing so. Warm banks operate on the same principle as food banks, which help people who can't afford to feed themselves or their families. More than 3,000 warm banks are listed on the website of the Warm Welcome campaign, which is organizing community responses to the cost of living crisis. Birmingham, the UK's second biggest city, has a network of hundreds of warm banks opening up. Fred Ratley, a coordinator of the Birmingham Poverty Truth Commission, told the local news website, "There was talk of 8, then 100. Now we think there will be hundreds." London, Glasgow, and Bristol are among the many other major UK cities with warm banks, and the hashtag warm banks and warm hubs are being used widely on Twitter to help people find places to keep warm. The UK raised its energy price cap by 80% on October 1st. The energy price cap is the maximum rate a supplier can charge for their default tariffs. The increase means the average gas and electricity bill for a UK household will jump to $4,228 a year from $2,349. The surge is largely a result of gas prices rising to record levels because of the Ukraine-Russia conflict. But higher energy costs aren't the only extra financial burden facing households. Inflation, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, is running at above 10%, meaning average weekly shopping bills are more expensive too. Some people's mortgage payments are also rising substantially because of repeated jumps in interest rates. And rental costs are rising at their highest rate on record as landlords pass on increased mortgage payments. The Guardian Daily reports Scotland's leading anti-poverty campaigners are urging councils and communities not to repeat past mistakes by allowing warm banks for those unable to afford heating their homes over the winter months to become as entrenched as food banks. The plea was made in a joint statement from the Poverty Alliance, Trussell Trust Scotland, and the Syrenians, that cautions that emergency responses to escalating fuel poverty, however well-intentioned, risk shifting the focus away from government responsibility to ensure all citizens are able to heat their homes. The notion of warm banks first entered wider discussions about the cost of living crisis in July, when it was raised by the consumer rights campaigner Martin Lewis. He suggested libraries and other public buildings could become the equivalent of food banks, where people who can't afford heating are invited to spend their days at no cost with heating. Since then, a number of councils across the UK, including in Bristol, Dundee and Aberdeen, have confirmed they are considering such measures. Recently, Scotland's largest local authority, Glasgow City Council, voted unanimously for green proposals to create a network of welcome places, which will offer welfare advice and refreshments, as well as a warm, dry venue. But those on the front line of fuel poverty are worried these efforts, though intended as a last resort, could normalize the experience rather than challenging governments to act. Peter Kelly, the director of the Poverty Alliance, told The Guardian, "Of course, we appreciate why these warm spaces are being set up, and they will be a lifeline for some, but it entrenches the idea that the welfare state is peripheral and contingent. Compare this to food banks. They were supposed to be an emergency response to austerity, and now we have an established and sophisticated network across the country."
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of arrogant powers, policies, and recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. You can send your children to school in the morning without having to worry. You can commute to your workplace, and you can attend Friday prayers without having to worry about anything. Just look at the countries that worry about these things. They can neither sleep well during the night, nor can they go to work during the day. They cannot freely watch a sporting match, nor can they attend Friday prayers or go on a vacation. And this does not just apply to smaller countries. In big countries, the US being the worst, there is no security in their restaurants. There is no security in their universities. There is no security in the schools. that their children attend. There is no security in their stores. That is the definition of security on a personal level. It means that you, your children, and your family are able to live your life while feeling secure. It means your job, business, vacation, and recreational activities are carried out in safety.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
With regard to issues that are more about the public, you need to be able to sit down, think, do your work, do research, and study different subjects in a university, a seminary, a research institute, or a think tank. You cannot do this if there is no security. If security did not exist, there would be no progress. If there is progress anywhere, it is because of the security that exists in that place. Without security, it is difficult to do any work. In addition, with regard to economic investments, if you want to make an investment in the economic development of the country, you cannot do this if there is no security. Transits cannot be carried out without security. Production is not possible without security. Security is the substructure for all of these things. Well, armed organizations are the ones who provide this never-ending universal need of the country and the general public. This is something you should be proud of.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
It was quite clear from day one that Washington is not after peace in Eastern Europe and is just using Ukraine as a pawn to suppress Russia. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. In this regard, Global Times wrote, what Washington is concerned about isn't the peace of Europe and Ukraine, but how to bring down Russia using Ukraine as a pawn and taking advantage of Europe, as well as how to consolidate its hegemony in Europe and across the whole world. The international community should discard any illusions about any of the U.S. moves which appear to promote peace. The Biden administration is privately encouraging Ukraine's leaders to signal an openness to negotiate with Russia and drop their public refusal to engage in peace talks unless Russian President Vladimir Putin is removed from power, according to people familiar with the discussions, the Washington Post reported recently. Instead of relieving or addressing the ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine, Washington's main purpose is actually to adopt a new strategy diplomatically in which Ukraine can gain more lasting support from U.S.-European allies in its conflict with Russia.
Although encouraging Kiev to engage peace talks with Russia, Washington just hopes to see a fruitless result. The U.S. intends to ensure that Ukraine holds the moral high ground amid the crisis. In a bid to obtain more continuous assistance from U.S. allies in Europe, Song Zhongping, a Chinese military expert and TV commentator, told the Global Times, Washington is to pave the way for the possible adjustment of USA to Ukraine in an attempt to prolong the ongoing conflict. Under U.S. instigation, if Ukraine talks with Russia, the negotiations will end up as a failure, as Ukraine can use the pretext that Russia could not meet Ukraine's conditions, and then the blame of the long-standing conflict between the two countries can be passed to Russia. In this scenario, Ukraine will be regarded as the constructive side to the Ukraine crisis, while Russia, the destructive one. As a result, Ukraine will gain more firm support and aid from U.S.-European allies. The Biden administration hopes its European allies to fill in the gap resulted from U.S. reduction, according to a Beijing-based expert who asked for anonymity. The U.S. does not want to see the military conflict between Russia and Ukraine end soon. For Russia, Ukraine, as well as Europe, the longer the crisis, the more detrimental for them. While for Washington, the longer the conflict, the more favorable position it will be in. In spite of European countries' economies and energy supply heavily hit by the ongoing crisis, they have to supply Ukraine with large amounts of military and financial aid. This is what Washington wants to achieve, exploiting Ukraine as a pawn to drag down Russia and Europe. And amid the whole process, the U.S. merely pays a light price. Meanwhile, RT wrote, Russia is discovering that its move away from the West is finding approval, even if some of the global majority may be wondering why it took so long. Military and political tensions in Europe have long been a catalyst for profound change in the structure of world politics and economics. And of course, they have often altered Russia's place in the world. While the signs of the former have been evident for at least a few years, the latter is now clearly visible. Last month's annual meeting of the Valadi International Discussion Club in Moscow clearly illustrated this trend and raised important questions. Many in Russia have long spoken of the need to move away from the Western-centric view of world, which has been inherent in our political conscientious for centuries. It is not a question of sympathies or antipathies, but of understanding changes in the world order. One cannot take a residual view of a vast part of the world where, as is now commonly said, the global majority live and where the most intensive development is taking place. No one argues against this, but it is difficult to overcome the deep-rooted tradition of evaluating our own actions through the prism of relations with the West. The events of 2022 forced this to be done in emergency mode. The West itself took the initiative. To start with the obvious, the non-Western world can be said to look sympathetically at Russia's attempt to break the system of Western domination of the international arena. Attitudes to the military operation in Ukraine ranged from understanding the reasons to regretting the humanitarian cost. But there was virtually no condemnation, much less calls for punishment for Russia challenging the West. And the reason for this is not approval of the actions in Ukraine, but precisely because the inhabitants of the former Third World consider it right and historically just to oppose former colonial overlords. In other words, the accumulated irritation with the West, in this case, manifests itself in a firm refusal to follow Western attitudes. And so it follows that an uncharted path emerges. Russia now speaks of the need for a world order in which all states are free to realize their cultural and national particularities without the standards being imposed from the outside. This idea has found enthusiastic approval. In Asia, Africa, and Latin America, the sense of injustice, which they believe permeates the entire Western-led world system, has long been at the heart of their views. That Russia has also come around to this way of thinking is welcomed, but it is perceived not as the founder of the trend, but rather as a newcomer who joined in after wandering. And justice is not a universal concept. Its interpretation is again a product of each community's culture, especially in the international arena, where the understanding of what is right is inextricably linked to the realization of national interest. Therefore, while justice as a slogan is good and right, as a guide to action is hardly applicable in practice. More precisely, it needs to be filled with every concrete step that the interlocutor will find beneficial, opening up new opportunities. The non-Western world, however, it views NATO countries has no interest in unnecessary conflict and complications. At least for now, while the restructuring of the global structure is only gaining momentum, the advantage that the West has at its disposal is large, although it is shrinking. So is the extent of Western influence on world processes. Accordingly, the realization of ideas of justice lies first and foremost in the creation of alternatives to the previous international monopoly and the possibility of building effective ways to interact and develop not against the West, but bypassing it without its involvement. Everyone has an interest in this, and the events of 2022 have shown that such a possibility exists. All the more so as the West itself, in seeking to punish Russia, has demonstrated the extent to which it is prepared to exploit its advantages. And by the way, to further speculate on the subject of justice, the furor around the Ukrainian grain deal has shown that talk about care for the weak and the poor can easily be used for special political, economic, and even military purposes.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The implementation of a comprehensive strategic partnership between China and Iran is getting a kickstart as a high-ranking delegation headed by the Chinese Vice Premier Hu Chunhua meets with Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi in Tehran. After his meeting with the Iranian president, the Chinese top official met with Iran's finance minister, where the two sides signed 16 MOUs to boost cooperation in different fields. Oil and gas, banking, investment, and strategic projects are the four fields of economic cooperation that are now on top of the agenda. There has already been a roughly 20% increase in trade, and the outlook for 2023 is even higher, according to Iran's finance minister. China is still Iran's biggest oil client, despite Washington's bid to bring Tehran's exports down to zero. And its close involvement in the built-out of Iran's manufacturing infrastructure is seen entirely in line with its Belt and Road Initiative. Analysts say this could represent a shift in the global balance of the oil and gas sector and create new markets where no U.S. dollars are involved.
Iran-China relations date back to the ancient Silk Road. Both countries have always had close ties, but over the past couple of years, their relations have become even more significant, with the U.S. putting pressure on China on the one hand and placing sanctions on Iran on the other. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Relatives, family members, and a group of activists gathered in front of the Swedish embassy in Tehran to demand the release of former Iranian judiciary official Hamid Nouri, who has been sentenced to life imprisonment by a Swedish court. The protesters condemned the politicized verdict issued against Hamid Nouri, who has been kept in solitary confinement for over 3 years.
On the one hand, by issuing a verdict against Hamid Nouri, the former Iranian official, based on accusations leveled by MKO terrorist group, Sweden has actually recognized the terrorist group and has allowed its members to live freely on its soil. On the other hand, during the legal procedure, Hamid Nouri has been deprived of his legal rights to defend himself properly in the court because he could not have access to an independent lawyer. He had no contact with his family for 8 months, and he has been under white torture.
Earlier, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian called on the new Swedish government to immediately release Hamid Nouri, saying the politicized case of Nouri and efforts by the Mujahideen Khalq organization MKO terrorist group to disrupt a legal probe into the case have seriously harmed relations between Tehran and Stockholm.
We demand that justice be done with regard to my father, because according to many lawyers, the Swedish court verdict against my father was totally politicized and has no legal ground, and there is no concrete evidence for providing the accusations against my father. Therefore, we condemn the court ruling and demand his immediate release.
Swedish authorities alleged that Hamid Nouri was involved in the execution and torture of the MKO members in 1988. He has strongly rejected the allegations.
According to Iranian officials, keeping an individual in solitary confinement for 3 years is tantamount to torture, which runs against EU Convention on Human Rights. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
More picket lines and travel disruptions as tens of thousands of rail workers across Britain walk out. Represented by the RMT Union, for months they have been asking the government for better working conditions and an increase in their pay to match the double-digit inflation. The government says the pay rises are unaffordable and has promised tough action against the unions. The unions say they're standing firm.
This latest round of strikes will show how important our members are to the running of the country, and will send a clear message that we want a good deal on job security, pay and conditions for our people. We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
The strikes come at a cost to the economy in terms of lost working days. And the right-wing media here have been counting that cost. Yet that doesn't seem to have dented public support for the strikers.
The cost of living has gone up, so if they need more money, then they should get a pay rise.
I can see where the rail workers are coming from. They want a pay rise. They're seeing their bills go up every month, and they want to make sure they can support their families at the same time.